Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Ed Miller. Ed Miller is a poker player and writer and a friend to the show. His modestly titled website is NotedPokerAuthority.com. Ed specializes in playing and writing about low-limit games. Ed Miller, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good to be back.
Yeah.
In breaking news today, the Palms has changed CEOs. Joe Magliardini is out, and Daniel Lee is in. Dan Lee has had a number of responsible gaming positions around the country. The Palms is one of our sponsors, and we wish them well with this move. Last week, we spoke with Michael Shackelford about Amir Levahotz selling pieces of himself for the November 9 tournament. Shaq announced that people had a 12% edge if they bought pieces of Levahotz. Since Levahotz was attempting to come out with a price which was exactly fair, assuming all players were equal, we asked Michael how come his estimate and Levahotz were so different. Michael went home, discovered his error, and he asked us to read the following. I'm afraid that I blew it in my calculation for the Amir Levahotz expected share of the World Series of Poker. After being challenged about it, I realized that I incorrectly treated the tournament as if the winner took the entire prize pool. In fact, the prizes for finishing second to ninth make the expected win more than proportional to stack size for the players with small stacks, and less for those with large ones. This is easy to illustrate why if every player got an equal prize. To find the correct answer, I wrote a looping program and entered the pertinent information into it. The results of my tournament poker calculator match exactly what the independent chip model is quoted as saying in the cardplayer.com article. Assuming each player is of equal skill, the value of each 1% share of the prize money, taking out the ninth place prize, is $29,248. This is exactly what Amir is charging. Investors must obviously have faith in his skill level to want to invest. As long as I wrote the program, I put it on my website for everyone to enjoy. You can find it at wizardofodds.com/games/poker/calculator. I apologize for the error, Michael Shackelford. Do you have any comments on this, Ed?
Well, one of the big things that distinguish poker tournaments from cash game poker is that you get paid for losing. You know, most of these tournaments are not winner take all. You lose all your chips, and still they hand you money at the end of the tournament, at least some people. And so the independent chip model, ICM, is the way that poker players model how much each stack size is worth in a tournament, because you can't just count up, you know, oh, I have 34 million poker, you know, tournament chips. That doesn't translate easily into a cash value. So Michael was right to go back and revisit his assumption and use all the prizes to decide how much it's worth.
So
I have to say I was really shocked by Michael's figure, just because there are an awful lot of really smart guys, you know, in the poker world, and a lot of them participating on 2+2. And it just would have really shocked me for this ICM to have a flaw that big. You know, there had to be something missing somewhere, you know, another piece of the puzzle. So doesn't surprise me that he ended up finding the same right. Same figure ultimately.
So, Ed, is it fair to say that you're not going to buy a piece of Amir for the tournament?
I'm not. I wish him the best of luck, and I hope he wins, and I hope he's worth exactly what he thinks he's worth, but I'm probably not buying.
All right. All right. Speaking of November 9th, in about a month, the November 9th will compete here in Las Vegas for the $8.5 million first prize in the World Series of Poker main event. Have you been following this, Ed? Do you have any predictions or best bets?
Well, the final table, it's interesting. I looked at all nine bios of the November 9th today, and as far as the World Series of Poker website claimed, eight of the nine are professional poker players. And that is kind of becoming the norm where, you know, the field starts out 6,000 people and a lot of them are amateurs. But by the time you get to the final table, really the amateurs, a lot of them fall by the wayside and you have a lot of tough professionals. So it's going to be a tough table. I don't think, you know, there's some big names. JC Tran is the chip leader and he's kind of a big name player. David Benefiel is, or used to be at least, one of the top cash game players in the world. And he's got a small stack, but he's still in there. And, you know, if I had to pick one person, I'd pick JC Tran. He's got the biggest stack, and he's an excellent player. So why not go with him?
All right. Very good. Munch, do you have a favorite in this?
Well, you know, I agree that JC Tran, I think, you know, is the favorite. Great player and biggest stack. You know, after I wrote a review of this book, Ship It Halabalas, on my on my website a month ago or so, and very entertaining book for any of our listeners who are interested in poker. Because of that particular book, you know, I sort of have a soft spot for David Benefiel, known as Raptor. Yep. And you know, I'd love to see him do well. And I understand he had actually taken quite some time away from poker and came back to play the World Series. And now he's on the final table. So kudos to him.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. The Poker Hall of Fame nominees have been announced alphabetically. Chris Bjorn, Umberto Brenes, David Chu, Thor Hansen, Jennifer Harmon, Mike Matisau, Tom McAvoy, Carlos Mortensen, Scotty Wynn, and Huck Seed. Ed, do you have any favorites on that list or predictions and how the vote is going to go?
Man, I have no idea. I think it's, you know, it's like, I mean, I can't even figure out who's going to go in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And those guys, their numbers are laid out for year after year. I have no idea how they pick who goes in the Poker Hall of Fame. So I couldn't, I mean, there's players on that list I like. I think Huck Seed is a sharp guy, and it would be cool if he got in, but, you know, who knows?
Well, it's going to be voted on by the living Hall of Fame members and 18 media members. Now, Ed, you write a column for Card Player. Are you one of the media members with the vote?
They didn't ask me. They didn't send me a ballot this year.
They skipped Munch and me, too. Go figure. All right. Archie Karras. A couple weeks ago, gambler Archie Karras was arrested for marking cards at the Barona Casino near San Diego, California. Karras is widely considered to be a cheat, but in the early 90s, over a period of 3 years, he won some $40 million from some of the world's best gamblers in a number of games. And then he lost it all a few years later. I only met Karras once, and he told me during his run there was no funny business going on. Now, this must have been a practice answer. Almost 20 years after the fact, I'm sure he'd been asked that question hundreds of times. I have no idea if it's true or not. Any comment, Ed?
Well, this guy's a little before my time, so I had to actually read his Wikipedia page to find out about this massive run he went on, and it sounds like most of it he won playing poker, actually, or at least a lot of it. And the list of scalps he took was the list of the top poker players at the time. You know, I don't know anything about him. I don't know anything about the situation. I will say this one thing. If say a gambler I knew of got caught red-handed cheating, got convicted. We knew for a fact he got caught cheating. And then I also knew that this gambler had had a miraculous run at some previous point in his life. It wouldn't. I don't think it would be a stretch to think there might have been funny business going on during the run. But again, I don't know anything about this particular guy. And but that would just be, you know, my Bayesian inference, I would say, you know, given the knowledge that I have.
Yeah, I have a couple of comments. First of all, there's a very good write-up on the whole run in a really great book called Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers.
I've heard of that. And who was the author of that?
I think it was me. But several of the people that I interviewed in my book talked about Archie, so much so that I had to include kind of a big sidebar about the whole incident. First of all, one of the things that Chip Reese said to me is, you know, he at one point had trouble getting action, you know, just because he had such a big reputation. It was hard for him to get good action. And he said it was certainly good for his reputation for people to hear that Archie Karras had beat him like a drum. So he was only too happy to spread, you know, that news. And, you know, it was nowhere near, I guess, the reality. The reality was nowhere near what, you know, what Archie was claiming and other people. And as this story has grown over the years, the numbers keep getting bigger and bigger, and the people he's beaten, you know, more and more. A second thing, I've always found the story very odd. The most odd thing was, you know, he won, I don't know, $25 or so million playing craps at the Horseshoe. And this is a guy who, at the time that this was going on, was in the Griffin book as a dice cheat, as a dice slider. Now, Jack Binion is no dummy. And for him to allow this guy to be there, knowing he's in the Griffin book as a dice slider, and get ahead $25 million at craps, I just thought, I've always thought the story sounded fishy. You know, and Jack Newton in his book claims that he went down and consulted with Jack Binion while this was going on. And he told Jack to put a rope under the felt. You know, they do this on crap tables to prevent the sliding of dice, right? If they put a string under the felt, and when if a die is slid, it hits that string and tumbles. And in Jack Newton's book, he claims that once they put the string under the felt, you know, Archie lost all the money back. Now, that story sounds bizarre to me too, because I just can't imagine they would have allowed him to be sliding dice, you know, the whole time to win that much money. You had to have every person in the casino watching him like a hawk. So who knows what the reality was. But he also had several other cheating incidents over the years. So I agree with Ed, you know, the idea that someone is a known cheat, wins all this money, you know, maybe there's more to the story.
If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, maybe it is a duck.
Yeah, yeah. And one other thing, one other thing I would say is, if I was going to cheat, one of the last places in the world I would try it is Barona. I think, you know, that was a big mistake on his part.
Now, for certainly that would be true for you. Your pictures on the wall there as being in the Blackjack Hall of Fame.
Aside from that, I mean, I'm not allowed to play at Barona. I'm actually, they comp me not to play. Which is, I think, a really great casino policy. More places should do that. But they are a very sharp casino. You know, there are a lot of really dumb casinos. That's not one of them. So But I'm assuming Archie didn't know that. So let's move on.
Let's move on. All right. All right. Now, Ed, Nevada now has two poker sites, Ultimate Poker and World Series of Poker. Have you played both? And if so, please compare and contrast.
I've just played on Ultimate Poker. World Series of Poker just went live with their real money, I want to say about 2 weeks ago, maybe. They had a promotion during the World Series where you could sign up for an account then and be entered in a drawing for free tournament entries during the World Series. So I signed up there, but I haven't put money on yet. I will say about what I've noticed is as soon as the World Series of Poker came online, they're now fighting with deposit bonuses. So what World Series of Poker wanted to give me $400 free bonus to put money on it, and then like 2 days later I got $500 free money from Ultimate Poker. So it seems there's some competition on, I would say.
Now, why did you not take advantage of that bonus?
It's a good question. I just didn't. It was a one-day only bonus, and I just wasn't at my computer all day. So.
Yeah. You know, I read a recent review, somebody comparing the two, and they said that clearly the software was much better with the World Series Poker software. And I guess they're at Ultimate Poker, they only have hold'em, correct? Only have very low stakes hold'em, whereas the World Series software, I guess, has some Omaha and some other games.
Well, it is true that Ultimate Poker only has hold'em, at least that I've seen. I wouldn't say it's only low stakes. I mean, they have games up to, you know, 5-10, which is, I wouldn't call that low stakes.
Okay.
Yeah, so, they actually have,
it
you know,
seemed like
occasionally
most of the games were, you know, 1 and 2 cents, 50 cents, up to 50 cents and a dollar, maybe some 1-2.
No, they have bigger games than that. I haven't played lower than 1-2 on the site. I played 1-2, 2-4. 3-6, I think, is what I played. So they have you know, decent sized games for sure on Ultimate Poker. At the World Series of Poker.com, I know, is using software from 888, which is established company that's been running poker sites for, I don't know, over a decade probably. So that software is going to probably be more polished out of the gate. I'm not surprised. Again, I haven't played on that site yet, but I'm not surprised to hear that their software is more polished because of their kind of pedigree.
Then the question is, why haven't you played on that site?
I just haven't had time. It's only been up for 2 weeks.
Okay, so but you will.
I plan to. Oh, absolutely. I don't have anything against it. I just haven't yet.
All right.
So now I was under the impression that you were sort of a daily online player. Is that not the case?
No, not for me. I have a 3-year-old, and that my schedule revolves around him. Sometimes I carve out time where I'm playing all the time, and then sometimes I'm on dad duty, and sometimes I'm writing a book. So no, I'm not a daily online player. I play, you know, for a while, and then I work on something else, and then I play for a while.
Are you still playing live in the casinos as well?
Yeah, I do. I play live.
Is it, for somebody with your skill, is it more profitable to play live or Ultimate?
It's more profitable online because you get more hands in. You know, you can play many more tables. I can play probably up to 8 tables if I'm my head's sharp. You know, and people who are younger and sharper than I am can play even more than 8. But you know, they can play 16 or 24, and they have their whole computer optimized to play poker real fast. But yeah, it's because of the volume you can get in. Your edge on any given hand is much lower online because the online players are much, much better. But you can play, you know, 5, 10, or even more times the hands per hour online. And so that's why it's going to be more profitable.
Actually, the review that I read, the player said that even in the small stakes, 10, 20 cent, you know, players were much better than, you know, what you would find in a live poker room.
There's no question about it because bad players, it's no fun for people who are bad to play online poker because they get crushed. And there's no sort of you know, there's no sort of gotcha moment. Like, like if you play live and you're not so good at poker and you catch a big hand and, you know, you can stand up and jump up and down and, you know, fist pump or whatever. And, it, you know, there you get that sort of moment of fun. And the game's much slower and you can, you know, enjoy the casino. Whereas online, you're just kind of sitting in your
pajamas
at home. And, you know, generally things aren't going well. And then you make your one big hand and you win $100 and there's no one there to see it. And then you lose and lose and lose and lose and lose. And then they just quit. So the bad players, you know, and they don't all, but many times they'll say they think it's rigged, but it's not rigged. They're just not very good. So that's what's going on with online poker. So that's what online poker is always much tougher than live poker for that reason, and among others.
And you play the cash games, right? You're not a tournament player?
Yeah, I rarely play tournaments. But
there's a book out there by Doug Hull called Poker Plays You Can Use. Mm-hmm. You're somewhat associated with that. Tell us about it.
Sure. Doug came to me about 2-3 years ago. He was, I would say, a sort of an average small to mid-stakes poker player. He played 2-5 on the East Coast. He was, in my opinion, sort of typical of an average player. His thought processes were very typical. In other words, he wasn't particularly good at poker. He came to me for some coaching. And the thing about him is most people who come to me for coaching, I offer an introductory package first 4 hours. We talk for 4 hours. And there's a lot of homework involved because, frankly, getting good at poker is there's a very steep learning curve and you have to put the work in. I liken it to, you know, going to the gym. I mean, if you want to get fit, you can't put the workout DVD in the TV, sit on the couch and watch it for an hour and expect to get fit. I mean, it's you watch the DVD, but the most important thing is that you do the work every day. And poker's exactly the same way. You're not going to get better at poker unless you put a commitment in half an hour every day to do really exercises to get better at the game.
And can you give us an example of some of those exercises?
Sure.
Or some of the homework you give people?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the most important thing you can do at poker is, you know, poker hands are played, there's pre-flop action, then they deal the flop, and then there's flop action, and then they deal the turn, and there's turn action, then they deal the river, and there's river action, and then the hand's over. So there's kind of four stages, pre-flop, flop, turn, river. The biggest hurdle for sort of amateur poker players is they think about each hand in a vacuum. You know, I have jack eight, what do I do with jack eight? I have king queen, what do I do with king queen? And they're not thinking about their general strategy. They're not thinking about their frequencies. You know, poker is a gambling game, just like any other gambling game. And, you know, you play roulette. If you put your money on any number and they pay you 35-1, you're going to lose. They pay you 40-1, you're going to win. Or if that number comes up 1 out of 32 times instead of 1 out of 38, you're going to win. It's all about frequencies and payoffs. And poker is the same way. But people don't think about their frequencies because what they just think about individual hands. So what I do is I force people for their homework to write out every single hand they could possibly have at this point in the hand. So let's say they raised preflop, and I say, okay, write out every single hand you would do that with. And then they say, okay, now the other guy called. Now the flop came this way, and the guy checked, and you bet. Or you didn't do anything yet. And then I say, go through every possible hand that you can have and decide whether you would better check with that hand. And then do the exact same thing for your opponent. Think about all the hands that your opponent can have the way that they've played so far. And think about what they're going to do. Are they going to raise? If you bet, are they going to raise? Are they going to call? Are they going to fold? And try to get some frequencies on that. So if you say, okay, well, they're going to fold. Here's, you know, they can have 250 possible hands. That's my guess. And if I bet, they're going to fold 130 of them. Well, 130 out of 250, that's more than half the time. That means I make money betting any two cards because their frequencies are wrong. They're giving me too many fold, you know, their fold frequency is too high for the situation. So you just do that over and over again. So now, okay, you bet, I bet, you called. So now we're on the turn, and now we do the same thing. Here's the set of hands I can have on the turn. Let's divide it up. Which ones am I going to check? Which ones am I going to bet? And likewise, which ones can my opponent have that they called the flop with, and how are they going to respond to a bet? And what you're doing is you're looking for frequencies that are out of whack in those ranges. And that's what makes you better at poker. And that's it's an abstract concept, and it's something you're not going to get until you just sit down with a piece of paper and just write hands out all day long and put check marks and X's. And that's why – and that really is the difference between – the pros really do this. I mean, pros have thousands of hours of literally basically doing that behind them, at least a lot of pros. The top pros do, whereas amateurs have 0 hours of that. And so they don't understand how – their whole strategy fits together, and that's why the pros can kind of demolish them. So, anyway, you asked about the book. Poker plays you can use. So the bottom line is, this guy Doug Hall came to me about 3 years ago, amateur player. I did this with him. You know, I kind of showed him what to work on, and lo and behold, he actually did the homework, and he worked on it and worked on it and worked on it and worked on it, and 2 years later, or 1 year later, really, he was playing at a professional level. And then a year after that, he'd written a book, and he wanted me to edit it. And so I was happy to do it. He wrote a fantastic book, and I went through it and kind of told him what parts I liked the best, and those were the ones he kept. And it's a series of hand examples that are designed to demonstrate these concepts. So it's hand examples where he shows you, he goes through the hand and he shows you make a bet here on the turn with this hand, even though it's a bad hand, because look what's going to happen. He's going to fold more than X percent of the time, and that's all you need to make this bet profitable. And it's just a bunch of hand examples that show you how professionals go about exploiting the bad play of amateurs.
What percentage of people, I think I know the answer to this coming before I ask it, but what percentage of people that actually spend the money to come to you and get some coaching actually go and do their homework?
Could I take the fifth? No.
Can you give us a sign whether it's more or less than 10%?
That's maybe about where I'd put the line, about 10%. I definitely have had successful students, but most of them, no. Yeah.
I used to get people who would come to me and wanted to learn how to play blackjack. And I very quickly learned, you know, that was, you know, just an exercise in frustration. So my standard line was go learn basic strategy and come back.
Right.
And basically nobody came. Once maybe 5% of the people would come back and say, I basically know it. And then I would ask them a few questions. You know, what do you do with A7 against a 9? And, you know, and invariably they would not be able to answer. They would fail on my 3-question test after they said they knew basic strategy. But, yeah, very – I think your analogy about the workout DVD is very accurate. People – it's like a diet book. They want to read the diet book and go to sleep and lose weight, you know, as opposed to actually doing what it takes to.
I'll buy that book.
Yeah.
So you've written a lot of books yourself. Would you say Doug Hull's book would be at a more advanced level than your books, a lesser advanced level of your books, or just not in the same?
I would say it's kind of like the most recent book I wrote is called Playing the Player. Uh-huh. You can get that on Amazon, too. I think it's an excellent book, and people really seem to like it. So if you're looking for one of my books, Playing the Player. And I would say Poker Plays You Can Use, again, that's Doug's book, is sort of a workbook, maybe, at about the same level as Playing the Player. So if you read Playing the Player and you say, okay, now I want some more examples, I want some more concrete application for what I just read, Doug's Poker Plays You Can Use book would be a great book to go to after that.
At one point on your website with the modest name, notedpokerauthority.com, you had, if you bought Doug's book, you got a discount on your book. Is that still in effect?
I don't think it is. That was an intro offer, but if you send me an email and ask me for a discount, I'll probably honor it.
especially if you mention gambling.
Absolutely. If you mention the show and send me an email and say you want a discount, absolutely.
Yeah, and you also could tell him if he's not going to honor the discount anymore, he should take it off of the modestly named website called NotedPokerAuthority.com.
I suppose that's fair.
All right. Now, we received a question for Ed Miller via email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. The question is, does limited access to online poker put American players at a disadvantage against non-U.S. players?
So about 2.5 years ago, online poker was available to American poker players via some of the major international sites, PokerStars, Full Tilt Poker. The Department of Justice cracked down, and it was essentially blackout for internet poker here in the country for about 2 years. It's now just popped up here just in Nevada. New Jersey's coming online soon, but most of the country is still blacked out. I think, yes, absolutely, that creates a huge disadvantage for American players. As I said, the best players are online. I mean, if you go play 2-5, 5-10 at a casino, you're going to find people who don't play poker very well. And that's great because you can win their money, but you're not going to get better. You're not going to become a top, top player playing in those 5-10, 2-5, 5-10, 10-20 games live, because you're not playing against the very best players, and you're not getting in hands. The tools are not available to live players that are available online. There's no databases. There's just so much more to get better at poker if you're playing online than playing live. So there's no question it's a disadvantage.
Are there databases that serve the Nevada online poker?
To be honest, I don't know yet. I don't have anything working. For me, but I would imagine it's coming. But as far as I know, the answer is no currently.
So basically, when you play on Ultimate Poker, it's just person number one, person number two, person number three.
Oh, there's screen names, but there's no data collection. I don't have a database of 100,000 hands that I've played that you can collect. Like if you play on PokerStars or another international site, there are software packages that slurp up all the hands that you've played over 2 years and into an enormous database that you can then search with incredible fine-tuned functionality. And that technology, to my knowledge, is not available at least for Ultimate Poker. Now, as we said before, WorldSeriesOfPoker.com has software from one of the international sites, so maybe that one would be compatible and you could do that. I'm not certain the answer.
But if these databases are available, then presumably that's going to make it all the easier to crush the amateur players.
Yeah, I think a little much is made of that. I think the databases are most useful for getting yourself better at poker. You know, they're best for you, your study, your independent study, to help you improve. They say, oh, there's HUDs and I get instant numbers on this and that. But really, I don't need that to beat amateur players. I mean, I don't know that having a number that says an amateur player plays 70% of his hands ever changes the way I'm going to play a hand against him. I know he plays way too many hands. I don't care that number is 70 or 50 or 55, I'm going to make similar plays, no matter. So I think too much is made of the fact that pros get specific reads on certain players using the databases. But much more, it is a very valuable self-evaluative tool.
To just look at your own stuff.
To look at your patterns and just to go back and just to have the history of all those hands that you've ever played that other people, you can go back and just look at a good player and just look at all the hands that you have that they've played and just kind of learn from them. I mean, there's just so many things you can do when you have 200,000, 500,000 hands in a database that can help you get better at poker.
Some of the poker softwares are going to anonymous play to prevent that, to stop people from using the databases.
Yes.
Which I think is actually good for poker. I mean, it's not good for the professionals, but it's good for the amateurs, which you need, to keep the game alive.
Yeah, it levels the playing field for sure. But at the same time, I also do think it does make it harder for new players to get better. You know, so yeah, maybe it curbs the edge that pros have on amateurs a little bit. But what it really does, to my mind, is it makes it hard for the new player who says, man, I want to spend the next year and get really good at poker. I think it makes it harder for that person to improve a little bit. So that would be I think overall it's fair. I think it certainly makes the game seem fairer, which is good too. But yeah, that would be the downside to me, is that it does make learning harder.
So I remember with poker table ratings, I think it was called, they would say, for example, you're folding too much on the turn, or you know, you're calling too much on the river or whatever. So those are the kind of stats you're talking about to.
Yeah, but I don't think that sort of gross analysis is very useful. You know, they'll look at, you know, your number is 39 and they have some thing in their software that says it should be 33 to 37. I don't think that's meaningful. It's more of a micro analysis. It's more of.
You need to know which 33 to 37 you should do.
Well, that and game conditions change what that number should be. I mean, if you're playing in primarily four-handed games or five-handed games, or you're playing with primarily tighter or loose, I mean, those numbers vary. So and the Poker Table Ratings, which was this large website that created an enormous database of, they tried to create basically a database of every single hand that got played on Full Tilt Poker and PokerStars. You know, full stop. So they had this monstrous database. You know, I think that's kind of ham-fisted analysis. It's just, you know, to look at one number and be like, that number's too high, that number's too low. You know, what the kind of analysis I'm talking about is much more kind of micro. Like, what do I do when there's three clubs on the flop? And what type of hands should I be bluffing with? And what type of hands should I be calling down? You know, gee, I fold every time, you know, because I don't have a flush, I'm folding, and I keep losing money in these pots. Maybe I should stop folding sometimes. Like, it's that kind of analysis that you're not going to get just from poker table ratings, for instance.
So how would you find that analysis? Were you able to search flops that are three of a suit?
Sure. Yeah, you could do all kinds of searching like that. You can search on pot size. You can search on flop type. You can search on, you know, hands where I flopped middle pair. You can search on hands that were where I re-raised pre-flop and didn't bet the flop. You can search. I mean, the searching. These were very powerful tools, and so you could pull up, you know, just a subset of situations and look how you're handling them, look how another good player is handling them, and try to learn from it. And you know, again, that's the kind of thing that you want to do if you're working on your game, you know, 30 minutes an hour every day. Is exactly that kind of analysis. Just say, hey, I want to get better playing when the flop comes all one suit, and I'm going to think about that situation in depth today, and tomorrow I'm going to be better at it, you know, and that's how you get better. So to me, that's the kind of analysis that's valuable.
That's interesting. Yeah.
You are a columnist for Card Player Magazine, and a couple years ago, you wrote a column, and it's now posted on your website. I forget the name of your website, but the article was called "Four Ways Your Bad Luck Is Really Bad Play." Let's take a couple of those ways. Your choice, which two? We have 6 minutes.
Okay.
Before we take a break, and then give us a poker lesson, a 6-minute poker lesson for our audience.
Okay. So, this was an article I wrote a while ago. This was actually the second one in the article, but the first one I'll talk about is overcommitting to vulnerable hands. So just to back up, the premise of the article is, you know, lots of poker players who frankly aren't that good at the game, or at least haven't gotten good yet, don't really understand what's happening to them. They don't really understand, you know, why money goes where it does when poker, you know, when people play poker. They don't really understand why they're losing, or you know, or maybe they're not losing overall, but they have days where they just, it goes all wrong, and they just feel like, you know, they had the, you know, the worst luck ever. And the reality is, sometimes bad luck is bad luck. There's no question about it. But sometimes bad luck comes from the fact that you're fundamentally misplaying certain hands. So one way that a lot of amateur players do it is they overcommit to vulnerable hands. And this is really comes from fear of the unknown and fear of the river. So what these guys will do is they'll flop one pair. So the example I gave is they have King Jack, and the flop comes Jack 10 8 with two clubs. So you've got top pair, you've got a pair of jacks with a king, but anyone or many amateur players will look at that hand and say, "Gee, I think I have the best hand now." But you know, anyone easily a straight could make come on the turn. Someone could make a flush on the turn. Someone could catch an ace and outdraw me. That half the deck looks really scary. So what they try to do is they try to slam the door shut on the hand immediately by making an enormous bet. So say there's $50 in the pot. When they get a hand like this, they'll bet like $120 into $50. And unfortunately, that's a terrible strategy, because what you're essentially doing is you're taking a hand. They recognize, gee, the hand's vulnerable. But what they don't understand is that makes the hand not that valuable. You know, it means you're going to get beat fairly often, and that's okay. You know, it's okay to have a hand that gets beat. What's not okay is to throw huge amounts of money at the hand that's about to get beat. So that's a big mistake I see, that they take these kind of middle strength, you know, hands that could go either way if they catch good cards, if they catch bad cards, and they overcommit way too much money and emotion to them early on. And then when things don't go well, you know, gee, someone flopped the straight, you know, and they get raised and they call it, and now they've lost $500 on this hand that really was probably only worth one or two small bets from the outset. So that's a big way that I see amateur players lose enormous pots when they absolutely shouldn't. They've just misevaluated. And then another way, the second way.
What would you bet? Would you check that hand, or would you bet small?
Sometimes I would check that hand, absolutely, or make a small bet. I mean, it's not necessarily a universal way to play that hand, but yeah, checking it is certainly an option. You want to be able to check hands on boards like that. People assume when you check a board like that that you can't have top pair, because what fool would check a pair on such a dangerous board? And so frequently you can just get people to bluff at you a couple times with their draws. And that way you're keeping the pot a modest size, and you're getting action from hands that are worse than you. So because the hand is really doesn't have that much equity to begin with, if you check it and it gets checked through, it's not a huge loss, because, the hand wasn't, you know, you were only maybe 60-40 to win that hand to begin with. So if you miss out on a bet at 60-40, you know, that's not the end of the world. So checking it is definitely an option.
All right. What was another one of the four ways your bad luck is really bad play?
Yeah, so the last one I have is camping out in a bad seat. And this is just, poker players have a lot of inertia. You know, I hear all the advantage gamblers that play blackjack, and you know, it sounds like they're a lot more, they must be in better shape than poker players. They must work out more, because it sounds like they're, you know, constantly having to, you know, switch tables, or you know, constantly having to reevaluate the situation and maybe leave at a moment's notice. Whereas poker players, they'll just plop in a seat and sit there for 10 hours. And they're not thinking about the situation at the table. And the fact is that depending on who's sitting on your left or on your right, you know, some seats can be a lot more valuable than others. The action in poker flows clockwise, and therefore the money also flows clockwise, which means that if you have somebody that's dumping money into the game, you want them on your right, because you want that money to be dumped into you first. Whereas if they're on your left, that money gets dumped away from you and it kind of reaches you last. So if there's a particularly bad player in the game, you want them on your right. And so, you know, and so often I see people, they sit in their seat and they just stay there for the whole time, and they don't even think about what the game situation looks like and if that seat across the table is going to be more profitable. So that's kind of my number two, and that's just inertia and not putting in that little bit of extra effort to try to improve the situation for yourself.
Well, that's opposite of what I would have thought. Munchkin and I play in a very low stake poker game three times a year with a bunch of good friends. and I think Munch is probably the best one at the table, and I'm probably the worst. And I have a bad night, I could lose $17, at least if you don't count the last hour. But I always want Munch on my right, because I think, and you're telling me I should have him on my left because he's the best player?
Well, I mean, if you're not good at poker, I don't think too much about what to do if you're really terrible at poker, besides not play. I guess you don't want the best player on your left if you're the worst player, because that's the situation I'm talking about. I'm talking about that's where the best player belongs, is on your left. So if he's found that spot, then he's in the right spot, and yeah, you're right, you're in a bad place. So from your perspective, yeah, you should... to defend yourself, you should probably try to put him on your right. But if you're one of the better players at the table, if you're there to scout the opportunity, you feel like, you know, Bob Dancer is at your table, but for some reason he's got $5,000 today instead of $5, then you should definitely try to get that player on your right so that his money comes through you first.
Very good. So watch out, Richard. Next time we play in that game, I'm after you.
Right. You were on my left the last time we played. So.
Yeah, it did me well one time, and the last time, no theory works well all the time, does it? All right. So we're going to do some commercials. There's a good chance we're going to come to your third or fourth reason, so don't go away yet. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anyone else. In October, you play for buffets. Play 300 points prior to 1 p.m. Monday through Thursday and earn a free lunch buffet. Play a total of 600 points prior to 8 p.m. and you earn a free dinner buffet, whether you've earned the lunch buffet the same day or not. The free video poker classes will take a week off because I'll be out of town. In 2 weeks, the free classes will continue Tuesday at noon in the showroom. And the game will be 9-6 Bonus Poker Deluxe. This is a game which returns 99.64% before the slot club and promotions. It's very similar to 9-6 Jacks or Better, except you get a lot more for four of a kinds and only half as much for two pair. The net effect is that Bonus Poker Deluxe returns 0.1% more with considerably higher variance. They have not announced any double point days in October. There's a good chance Halloween. At South Point, they tend to have double point days on holidays, and Halloween would count. If you show up there, you probably shouldn't have a mask over your face, or you may get more attention from security than you want. At the Palms, this weekend is the first one of their $100,000 monster truck drawings. 10 winners each night, each weekend night, Friday and Saturday, will receive between $250 and $1,500, and each will receive an entry into the truck drawing, which is held twice, once on Saturday, October 12th, and once on Saturday, October 26th, immediately after the regular drawing. If you win the truck, you get $30,000 credit at Finley Chevrolet or $24,000 in cash or free slot play. PEW's Play, Earn, and Win for the first half of the month have a theme of variety of the spice of life. There's an eclectic mix of gifts from a Keurig coffee brewing machine to a rocking chair to a Tiffany lamp to 2 liters of Coca-Cola. Generally speaking, most of these gifts has been offered in the fairly recent past, so I'm assuming that this is an overflow. And what what people didn't want in May, they're getting a chance to take in October. Unredeemed points earned Monday may be redeemed either Wednesday or Friday. Unredeemed points earned Wednesday may be spent on Friday. On Tuesday and Thursdays, you may earn Albertsons or Costco gift cards at a rate of 40,000 points per $100 worth of gift cards, or 0.25%. Unlike the PEW gifts, unredeemed points from Tuesdays do not carry over until Thursday. At videopoker.com, the daily contest today is Wheel Poker. Tomorrow, the contest will be Ultimate Four of a Kind Bonus. Saturday, October 5th, the contest will be Super Triple Play. I haven't spoken about the game Super Triple Play, so I'm going to spend a bit of time discussing it now. Super Triple Play may be triple play, five play, or ten play. It's a six coin per line game, and you get a higher return for all four of a kinds, and occasionally for other pay schedule categories as well. Basically, it's a way to add excitement and variance. If you're going to be hitting a lot of four of a kinds today, this is a wonderful game to be playing. If four of a kinds will be absent from your machine today, this game really sucks. Unfortunately, I know of no way to accurately predict how many quads I'm going to be hitting in the next hour or so. VideoPoker.com is giving away a free month's gold membership to everyone who attends one or more of my free video poker classes at the South Point this semester. The gold membership allows you to avoid the pop-up commercials on the site and also gives you correction on many games, such as Quick Quads. And that's a game where you can't get corrections anywhere else. Next week's show has already been taped. I'm going to be out of town. I'm going to be on a cruise to Bermuda, seven-star cruise out of Caesars Entertainment. And so last Monday, Munch and I went into the studio and taped the show. The guests we were expecting to have bailed for personal reasons. And so Richard and I spent the hour telling gambling stories out of our past that we hadn't shared on the radio before. I know his stories are very interesting. Hopefully you'll find both our stories enjoyable. In 2 weeks, our guest is attorney Bob Nersessian. If you have any questions for Bob, please send them to us on Facebook or at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com.
All right. The Facebook is facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge.
All right. Ed, we've talked about two of the four ways that your bad results can be because you're a bad player. We have 2 minutes left, so give us another one.
I want to say even good players can play bad sometimes. So it doesn't mean you're necessarily a bad player just because you do these once in a while. But the third one is paying off when you're outdrawn. And this is something that you can't avoid when you are playing against strong players, say online. You can't avoid paying them off sometimes. But when you're playing in a live game, like a 2-5 game in a casino, frequently your opponents are simply not going to bluff often enough for big money to make it worthwhile calling big bets. So let's say you get to the river and some straight card comes in, and all of a sudden, you know, you bet and your opponent makes a $350 raise. Well, you fold. You know, unless you can't beat whatever the nut, you know, whatever the sort of fairly obvious nut hand is, or whatever it is that they could have, you need to fold to that bet, because most amateur players are simply never going to make a raise like that and be bluffing often enough. So, but too often I see people, they get that raise, they know what it means, they sigh, they say, oh man, you must have caught me on the river, and then in goes their $350 to see the inevitable. So that's the big one. If you're playing in a 2-5 no limit game and somebody puts the big money in on you and you know you get that sinking feeling, it's much better for you just to always fold in that situation than to pay off and see what you pretty much know is coming.
Boy, I see people fall into that trap. I mean, it just seems like they were dealt pocket.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Ed Miller. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes this week. Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.